I'm Rich Adams, and the guest at the National Press Club is Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, the President of Pakistan. Bhutto has been President of Pakistan since the 1971 war with India, which resulted in the division of Pakistan and the creation of Bangladesh. Since that military defeat, Bhutto has spent much of his time trying to restore the morale of the Pakistani people. He's also faced with serious financial problems, and if that isn't enough, Pakistan has undergone serious flooding this year, resulting in severe famine. Emergency food aid and more military hardware were the major items on the agenda in President Bhutto's talks with President Nixon yesterday and this morning. Bhutto is familiar with this country. He did undergraduate work at the University of California in Berkeley in the late 40s and worked on the unsuccessful senatorial campaign of Helen Gahagan Douglas, who was defeated by President Nixon. And now to the podium and the introduction.
Good afternoon. I'm Don Larrabee, president of the National Press Club, and we're honored again today to have a distinguished head of state as our speaker. His words will be transmitted throughout the United States by way of National Public Radio, and to television viewers in Pakistan, they will see and hear this luncheon program via satellite. To tell you a bit more about our speaker, we are happy to have with us the chief of the Reuters Bureau here in Washington, former president of the National Press Club, and a journalist in the very finest traditions of our profession, John W. Heffernan, better known as Pat to his press club friends. Pat Heffernan.
Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, first of all, I'd like to say how nice it is to command this microphone once more. It's 4 years ago since I addressed a luncheon here. We're honoring today a man about whom it has been written with just a dash of impertinence, but I would suggest a feeling for the political dynamism which he generates. And the quote says that he blends the styles of a diplomat, a benevolent despot, and a circus barker. In fact, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto has obviously proved himself to be the man Pakistan needed in her gravest hour. Many qualities have been attributed to him, but one which to me stands out is that he is an undoubted optimist. Only an optimist could have taken on the job as leader of his country at the end of 1971, after one half of the country had gone and Pakistan had suffered humiliating military defeat. Only an optimist could still exhort his countrymen now to make new sacrifices in the wake of the recent devastating floods, which have caused havoc and untold financial losses. The Prime Minister has another quality which probably makes President Nixon just a weeny bit envious. That is his aptitude for being first. He was the youngest ever cabinet minister on the South Asian subcontinent. He was the first Pakistani minister to negotiate a major agreement for the exploration of oil with the Soviet Union. In 1968, he became the first Pakistani politician to launch a mass movement against a seemingly entrenched leadership, which was becoming increasingly unresponsive to the popular sentiment. In 1971, he became not only the youngest Pakistan chief of state, but also the first to have entered that office at the head of a political party with a landslide victory in the country's first one-man, one-vote general election. And the Prime Minister is the first Pakistani leader to have received his university education partly in the United States at Berkeley, as well as the first Pakistani chief of state to have begun his career after his country became independent in 1947. Part of Mr. Bhutto's success is probably due to the quality of doerness, perhaps stoicism, which the Pakistanis seem to share with the Scots, among others, which reminds me of the Scottish story. And if you think it might be odd to have a Scottish story told at a Pakistani event, I would reply that it is no more unusual than the Prime Minister in his toast at the White House banquet last night finding a link between Jill St. John and Rackrell Welsh and his quest for red-hot weapons. So to the Scottish story, which illustrates that there are still parts of Scotland where the Sabbatarian tradition dies hard, where it is considered sinful to listen to a radio on a Sunday, and where even singing birds in their cages are covered up on the Lord's Day. It was in such a locality that the parish minister used to spend Sunday afternoons walking across the moors with his young son. On this particular occasion, the father and the son plodded on, mostly in silence, for the best part of an hour, at which point the young boy, walking a few paces behind, ventured to ask, "Father, can I whistle? Can I whistle?" To which came the grudging response, "Hey, you can whistle, son, provided you're not enjoying yourself." Well, the Prime Minister can indeed claim to bring joy to Pakistani ears as he travels across the country, showering what Malcolm Brown, the New York Times correspondent, has described as a glittering trail of oratory. Some of the Prime Minister's Western critics call him, I'm told, the Hubert Humphrey of Pakistan, because of his capacity for delivering rapid-fire speeches that can last for a long time. He switches from Urdu to Sindhi to English, depending on his audience. He can also turn up in baggy Pakistani trousers, an Air Force flying jacket, a jaunty blazer, or anything else that seems appropriate to the setting. Mr. Bhutto, according to correspondent Brown, seems somehow to be the servant of the popular will, while in fact he rules as absolutely as any of his military predecessors. He may ask a crowd if he is right in doing something he's already done, in order to hear 100,000 voices roar, "Yes!" The regime he replaced, the correspondent adds, was made up of generals who were often distant from other Pakistanis. Mr. Bhutto, on the other hand, has thrust himself into a position of maximum visibility, almost forcing the world to look at him. Mr. Bhutto comes from the aristocracy of Pakistan, but has drastic ideas about reducing the power hitherto enjoyed by the rich landholding class. The slogan of the party which he founded is Islam, Socialism, Democracy. He is a product not only of Berkeley, but also of Christ College, Oxford, and Lincoln's Inn in London. He and Begum Bhutto have two daughters, one of whom went to Harvard, I believe, and two sons, one of whom is here today. I talked earlier of Mr. Bhutto's attributes. An important one is that he gets on, and I know this from personal knowledge, that he gets on well with foreign newsmen, which perhaps is why he receives a favorable world press, and why I am sure you will give him a specially warm welcome here today. I have the honor to present the Pakistan Prime Minister, Zulfikar Ali Bhutto.
Thank you very much. Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, I know this forum. I've been here before. Knowing the drill, I intend to speak up to 2 o'clock. I see here many friends across the tables. I've known them in the United Nations and during my many visits to your great country. I've also known them in England. Some of them are journalists from there. So I say hello to my friend. It's nice to see them. After I have heard the questions, I'll say hello to my enemies. Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, I thank you for affording me this opportunity to come to this world-renowned institution. Some of you may perhaps remember that I was here some years ago as the foreign minister of my country. I carry a pleasant memory of that encounter. I use the word encounter advisedly. I mean by it an exchange which not only serves to clarify issues, but also probes the depths of a situation and leads to a fruitful understanding. Before I answer the questions which you may have in mind, I feel it may be useful to tell you something briefly about Pakistan, which has a long history of cordial relations with the United States. As you probably know, great changes have taken place in my country since I last visited the United States in the desperate days of December 1971. These changes encompass every aspect of our life. They have transformed the country geographically, politically, economically. If I may put it briefly, the Pakistan of today has little resemblance to the pre-1971 Pakistan. We call it a new Pakistan. Let me tell you why. Geographically, it is no doubt a Pakistan reduced in size by the separation of its eastern part. But it is also far more cohesive and united, far more confident of its future. Politically, it is a Pakistan which is determined to nurture democratic institutions. As you know, Pakistan was ruled by a military dictatorship for more than a decade. It is my country's pride that after 12 years of military rule, which inevitably devitalized our political life, we have firmly established civilian supremacy and a government accountable to the people. Those who belong to countries with centuries of democratic tradition cannot fully imagine the struggle which is involved in the effort of an underdeveloped country to end an authoritarian system and hammer out a parliamentary and federal constitution. It is one thing to borrow a constitution from another society and hope that it will work. It is a different thing to evolve a constitution with the force of one's own authentic experience and aspirations. I was privileged to play a part in the popular movement for ending the long night of arbitrary government in Pakistan. The movement reached its fruition when we finally adopted, with the unanimous agreement of the people's elected representatives, a constitution which ensures the maximum autonomy of the units of the federation and at the same time safeguards national solidarity. Socially and economically, it is a forward-looking Pakistan which has reason to believe that, given the industry of its people, given their resilience, given their resolve not to be laid low by disasters, given the pragmatism of its approach and its freedom from doctrinal prejudices, it will emerge as a completely self-reliant society, no longer dependent on the assistance of its friends in the not-distant future. Some of you perhaps remember the canard that was spread throughout the world in 1971 that West Pakistan was not viable and that its economy would collapse if East Pakistan's export earnings were denied to it. The lie has been effectively nailed by subsequent events. In 1972, we reached an all-time high in our foreign exchange earnings, higher than those of East and West Pakistan put together in any previous year. This recovery was remarkable by any reckoning. It is, however, tragic that just when we were looking forward to reaching a point when this resurgence would bring real prosperity to the common man, we were stricken by the devastation wrought by unprecedented floods. This has forced a revision of our economic programs, but we are confident that, with the help of the international community, combined with our own exertions, we will overcome the effects of this calamity. These, in brief, ladies and gentlemen, are some broad facts pointing to a new Pakistan. But it would be altogether misleading to imagine a discontinuity in the international existence of Pakistan before and after 1971. It was alleged in 1971 that with the break between East and West Pakistan, the very foundation of Pakistan as a state had crumbled. History itself is giving a crushing reply to this highly motivated assault on our ideology. The emergence of Bangladesh has confirmed rather than negated the basic principle which constitutes our raison d'etre. For what is Bangladesh except that part of Bengal which has a Muslim majority? What is her independence predicated on except her distinctive Muslim personality? What except its being a Muslim area validates its separation from and prevents its absorption in Indian Bengal? That is why I called it Muslim Bengal, a truthful description which was not meant to give offense to anyone. If I say that Bangladesh owes her existence to Pakistan, I am surely pointing to the historical truth that there would have been no Bangladesh if there had been no Pakistan. The two important consequences directly flowing from this truth. First is that the common basis of the nationhoods of Pakistan and Bangladesh should override and transcend their differences. These differences were the result not of exploitation of East Pakistan by West Pakistan, but the exploitation of both by a junta which functioned in total isolation from the people. The second is that between a democratic Pakistan and a democratic Bangladesh, the natural relationship would be one of fraternal context. I have taken a number of initiatives towards bringing about the reconciliation and readjustment which would be of benefit to both. The initiatives for peace taken by Pakistan are meant to transform the situation in the South Asian subcontinent. In an address to the parliament of my country, I said that India and Pakistan should not be sworn to eternal enmity. I asked the people of both countries to realize that poverty was their common enemy. This is a conviction that is rooted in the social-economic outlook and orientation of the Pakistan People's Party, which I am privileged to lead. There is no question, therefore, of seeking a continuation of the confrontation between India and Pakistan, far less an arms race between the two. But peace cannot be sustained by illusions. Peace does not mean that the smaller of the two countries must lack a credible deterrent to aggression. The fact Pakistan has been subjected to aggression more than once is well known. The fact also that India maintains an indigenous military industrial establishment reinforced by generous supplies from external sources, even though none of her neighbors does or can, pose a threat to her security. A peace that would leave Pakistan exposed to aggression would be a peace by diktat. It would be a peace subsisting on imbalance. It would be inherently unstable. Let me make it clear that in no case will Pakistan submit itself to any dominance or hegemony, Indian or otherwise. That these trends towards hegemony exist in South Asian region, with its proximity to the Persian Gulf, is the principal reason why it is essential that the smaller countries in it should be furnished adequate means to defend themselves against any threat or attack from outside. Denied such means, they will be a prey to constant anxiety and exposed to perennial pressures. Such pressures produce a chronic tension which cannot but eat into the vitals of peace. Such a drift in affairs is something that my government is anxious to avoid. I feel that in this objective, there cannot be but an agreement in principle between the United States and Pakistan. Each is wedded to the incontestable proposition that only an equilibrium can ensure stability. If the implications of this identity of aim are concurrently worked out, I have no doubt that the relationship between our two countries will blossom into active collaboration in the service of peace. As you know, the United States and Pakistan have had a traditional friendship originating from the time when Pakistan was established as a sovereign state. There were times when the relationship was subjected to some strain. There was a period in the middle 60s when a perfectly rational relationship between Pakistan and its great Asian neighbor and friend, the People's Republic of China, was misunderstood in the United States. We are happy that that era of mistrust has passed and the United States itself has taken splendid initiatives towards a détente and a dialogue between the great powers. I'm happy that the cloud which at one time threatened to loom large over our relations has thus vanished, I trust forever. Pakistan is a country which has not anchored itself in a position that predicates a conflict between the great powers. In giving importance to its alliance with the United States, it is not seeking a reversion, a retrogression to the conditions which were those of a bygone era. We are thinking of the conditions of today and tomorrow. I am hopeful that these will lend a new positive dimension to the relationship between our two countries. It is a relationship which is not directed against anyone. Indeed, if it is sustained, it is my faith that it will operate to the benefit of others besides our two countries. In making war impossible in South Asia and the adjacent region, in preventing imbalance or penetration, in averting any dominance, it will help the teeming millions of that region to reclaim their dignity and their inheritance. I thank you.
We appreciate the brevity of your formal remarks. We have lots of questions. Did you, in fact, Mr. Prime Minister, ask the President to change the American arms supply policy?
No.
No?
No.
I think I understand you. But what kind of arms do you believe Pakistan needs, and what purpose will they serve?
This is going into details. We would much rather discuss the basic principles.
Will the United States take another look at providing hot weapons to you, or will the present embargo remain? That's another way of asking the question.
I'm not trying to evade an answer, but believe me, we have not tried to complicate your position. We understand your policies. We are aware of the mood in the Congress. We are aware of the mood of the American people. And it does not become a friend and an ally to complicate the trend of events.
Mr. Prime Minister, what, in your view, is the real essence of the Nixon Doctrine in practice as we have seen it carried out up to now? The Nixon Doctrine.
It is the privilege of the great powers to have doctrines. And each doctrine is valid not only for its own times, but it leaves behind a link for future doctrines to emerge out of it. Beginning with the Monroe Doctrine up to the Nixon Doctrine, we have seen the Truman Doctrine and many others, as I have said. As far as the past doctrines are concerned, they were valid in their time. And they left the link for new doctrines to emerge. And we believe that there are many valid truths in the Nixon Doctrine. As far as Pakistan is concerned, it is complying to the essence of the Nixon Doctrine, not because the doctrine stipulates certain elements, but because we find these to be self-evident in the recovery of our own country. We are making gigantic efforts to effect a recovery in our country, and we hope that we will receive sympathetic responses from all our friends. This, I believe, is the essence of the Nixon Doctrine as we understand it.
You speak warmly of Bangladesh and of common problems of Pakistan and India. Is there any possibility that you might initiate a South Asian League of Nations or a community of interests, say, among Pakistan, India, Bangladesh, and other neighbors such as Afghanistan, Nepal, so forth?
It's a premature question. there is a qualitative difference between the situation in Europe and the situation in Asia. In Europe, matters seem to have crystallized. In Europe, the basic tensions and the causes of disputes seem to be disappearing. As such, historically, we can evolve ourselves to a plane where an all-European conference can be held for the security of Europe as a continent. Asia, on the other hand, is still in a state of flux. The Vietnam War has barely ended. There is struggle and strife in Cambodia, and Laos also is in a similar situation. There are sharp boundary disputes and differences between many neighboring states in Asia. Therefore, from a political and a historical point of view, I do not think that we have come to that road. We have not come to that point where the situation can crystallize as in Europe.
What do you foresee as the role of the People's Republic of China in Asia, aggressive or passive?
This is an outdated question. It was relevant some years ago. Now, with the dialogue of your government with Chinese leaders, it would be more appropriate for your own leaders to make an evaluation. As far as we are concerned, our relations with the People's Republic of China have remained cordial from the time of the revolution in China, that is in 1950. We recognized the People's Republic of China, and since that time, our relations have developed well, and we have also made the same efforts to develop good relations with our other neighbor, the Soviet Union.
Both the Soviet Union and China have interests in South Asia that have them closely related to the two major countries in the area. Is the proper U.S. role one of balancing, that is, to prevent dominance of the area by either the USSR or China?
Sometimes we get prisoners of phrases, and these phrases, like balance of power and hegemony and others, are all right in their own place. But to answer this question more fundamentally, I would say that the old conception of the role of the United States in Europe, role of the United States in Asia, cannot be separated anymore. There is no distinction left between Asia and Europe in the broader sense of the term. There is a continuity, a contiguity of territory. There are historical links. With the end of the era of imperialism, the barriers and divisions between Europe and Asia have vanished. Much of European civilization takes its root from the civilizations of Asia and of the Middle East. The Christian and the Western civilization, the cradle of it is in the Middle East, and many of the incursions and ingresses of Europe also took place from Asia. So you cannot now draw a distinction of the role of a great power in one continent or another. I would say that this is one of the main reasons why the Soviet Union is anxious to be a European power and simultaneously an Asian power.
What is the position of Pakistan on the crisis in the Middle East?
Crisis in the Middle East has tormented us as it has given anxiety and trouble to the rest of the world. We are close to the Middle East, and anything that happens in the Middle East has its repercussions in the subcontinent. We have seen that in the past, and I have no doubt that the same situation will arise in the future. There is an affinity of interests, historical, cultural, geographical, between the subcontinent and the Middle East. So we would be happy, we would be extremely happy to see an end to that strife and struggle. This is a challenge which is for all of us, but the challenge is greater for those who wield greater responsibility in world affairs.
Has the USSR offered any altruistic aid for Pakistan?
Is there such a thing as altruistic aid?
Reports today say that India has settled a $3 billion debt for $100 million and $900 in rupees with the U.S. What success have you had? Our aid to India has been far greater than your aid. How much new economic aid will you get from the United States?
You might be surprised to hear this, but we did not go into the question of our debts, nor the question of rescheduling of our debts. We have incurred these debts, and we hope that with our own sustained efforts and with the energy of our people, we will be able to repay these debts.
Did you receive any specific promises of wheat or other food relief aid?
This is one matter in which we made a concrete request. We are mindful of your own problem. We know that the situation here is different from what it was in the past. We are aware of the anguishes of the housewife on rising prices, and we don't want to complicate your own problems. But as I have said, we have suffered devastatingly from the recent floods, and I'm afraid our situation will become highly complicated if we are unable to get the barest minimum requirements for our essential needs.
Here are related questions. When will true democracy come to Pakistan? How far do you plan to take your Islamic socialism in the course of your present term of office?
Democracy has returned to Pakistan. I don't know what is meant by true democracy. There, you either have democracy or you do not have democracy. Democracy does not brook compromises. And anyone who thinks that you can tie democracy to a leash or to close the floodgates of democracy, that individual has failed to recognize the force of democracy. We have a federal constitution which has been unanimously given to the people of Pakistan by their elected representatives. That constitution has come into play. Now, I know that there might be occasions on which, in the absolute sense of the understanding of the word, and in faraway places with strange-sounding names, people might think that this is not exactly their concept of democracy. You had the Wild West. West Pakistan is pretty wild.
Do you not think the extent of military rearmament in Iran and the Shah's public statements to assist Pakistan alters the balance in South Asia to the extent that Pakistan need not press so hard for a military buildup? I have another question. To what extent will Iran help Pakistan in the event of new trouble on the subcontinent?
I want to make it emphatically clear beyond all doubt that we are not receiving any military assistance from Iran. This is not correct at all. Iran has the resources to build her defense forces. She is purchasing sophisticated weapons with hard cash, and Iran is the master of her own destiny. Iran sees her position according to her own light. She believes that she has a role in the Persian Gulf, and she believes that the Persian Gulf will become more and more excitable in the future. So Iran is arming herself for her own needs. And nations, and particularly underdeveloped nations, do not arm themselves to pass those arms on to other underdeveloped countries. I want to make that position abundantly clear. And as far as the question of Iran's assistance to Pakistan in the event of war between India and Pakistan, let me say that we do not visualize that future. We will work against that future. We do not want to see the subcontinent ripped apart by conflict and carnage anymore. And we have already made sustained efforts to arrive at a modus vivendi with India. We have seen it is easier to make war than to make peace. We have accepted the challenge to make peace. And I have no doubt that the government of Madam Indira Gandhi will respond to these urges.
Is Pakistan now ready to reconsider joint defense offer of India extended several times in the past by Indian prime ministers? Not, why not?
Factually, the position is not correct. It is the other way around. In the year 1959, in March 1959, the then president of Pakistan offered joint defense to India, and he went to Delhi to advocate the proposition with the prime minister of India, Pandit Jawaharlal Nehru. And the response of Pandit Jawaharlal Nehru was to discuss the manuscripts of the India Library. situation has also changed. At that time, the world was looked at in terms of black and white. The world is no longer in that black and white position. There is plenty of gray on the political horizon.
Someone wants to know what are the components of Islamic socialism. Socialism without a Marxian basis, or what?
Islamic socialism would mean the historical, the traditional aspects of Islam to remain unimpaired. It would mean that our culture, our civilization, rooted and based on our faith of Islam, is supreme, and that our polity will take into account our milieu in determining what advances we can make in this world of technology and in the contemporary times. Our socialism, in that sense, is restricted to the economic aspects of Marxism. That is further restricted by the conditions of the present times, which is further restricted by the amount of foreign assistance we can get, which is further restricted by the amount of foreign investment that can be made.
Well, that leads into a question I've been saving from the U.S. banking community. What investment opportunities would you recommend to United States investors going into Pakistan?
There are plenty of opportunities for investment in Pakistan. We have opened our industries for foreign investment in any field, whether it be petrochemicals, cement, fertilizers, textiles, petroleum, tourism, hotels, and there is no restriction on the scope of foreign investment in Pakistan.
Has Pakistan reconciled itself to the loss of East Pakistan?
In a sense, yes. It has. Our eastern part has been separated from us. It has been a traumatic experience. But I would qualify it by saying, in a sense, we see the reality of the change. Emotionally, I think our people will take a very long time to be able to reconcile themselves to it.
What specific commitments does the United States have to defend Pakistan? Have such commitments been met?
This is an important question. The United States made various commitments to defend Pakistan or to support the territorial integrity and viability of Pakistan. The first commitment was actually made in 1954 when we signed our bilateral mutual agreement with the United States. It was made also in the CENTO and SEATO context. It was made again in 1959 by another bilateral treaty between Pakistan and the United States. It was declared by John Foster Dulles when he was Secretary of State that the United States would come to Pakistan's assistance in the event of aggression from any quarter, not only from any particular quarter, but from any quarter. If Pakistan were to be a victim of aggression, the United States would put behind her power and influence to prevent that aggression. It was made again by Mr. Kennedy, John F. Kennedy, when he was President of the United States, in a joint communique which was issued between him and President Ayub Khan. It was made by President Dwight Eisenhower. It was also made by Mr. Harriman when he visited the subcontinent during the Sino-Indian conflict of 1962, and again reiterated by a number of United States envoys sent from the United States to Pakistan, and those envoys that came from Pakistan to the United States. And when we were subjected to aggression in 1971, you will recall that 105 countries of the United Nations in the General Assembly supported Pakistan's position in the sense that they protested against aggression, against Pakistan's territorial integrity. And the present administration at that time was only one of the 105 countries which supported the resolution of the General Assembly. And that is why, really, it is an enigma to me when there is reference to a tilt towards Pakistan. that was not a tilt towards Pakistan in the subjective sense, if you take into account the commitments and our relationship, it was an exposition of a fundamental truth.
A world grain reserve would undoubtedly be of assistance to countries like Pakistan in its recent flood. Would you please respond to the statement this morning by the United States Secretary of Agriculture, Earl Butz, that current FAO estimates of a 9 million ton shortage of wheat is wrong, and that the United States will not pay any longer to store the world's reserve of grain?
There is a shortage, an acute shortage of grains, particularly wheat, and there have been shortages of edible oil, and we are in an unusual year. But at the same time, we have also noticed that a ban on exports of wheat has not been imposed in the United States, and that some steps have been taken by your government to remove the restrictions which were formally imposed on farmers for the cultivation of wheat and of edible oil. And this year, I believe, the output of edible oil in the United States will be 23% more than what it was last year. So I think that the United States will be in a position to meet her internal requirements as well as any humanitarian assistance that she would like to give to countries affected by famine conditions. As far as multilateral assistance in wheat is concerned, that is also welcome. But we have found that bilateral arrangements are simpler and more expeditious, and they also further develop better understanding between the countries.
Once current disputes such as war crimes, trials, exchange of persons, and recognition are settled, what kind of relationship do you envision between Pakistan and Bangladesh?
We would like to see the promotion of the best relations with Bangladesh. We went through a common struggle for the creation of Pakistan, and I would go so far as to say that it would have been more difficult to attain Pakistan had it not been for the people of East Bengal to have been in the forefront of that struggle. More than 2 million lives were lost and sacrificed. East Bengal played a prominent role in the achievement of Pakistan. We lived together as a nation for 25 years, and we have parted now, but we look optimistically to the future and with great hope for a reconciliation.
Do you believe returning some religious sites to Sikh control would ease tensions on the India-Pakistan border?
This is only a peripheral matter.
What are the prospects for settlement of the Kashmir problem?
I better have a glass of water.
<Go ahead. laughs>
It's a complicated problem. Our position is well known. We are committed to the right of self-determination of the people of Jammu and Kashmir. But we are prepared to discuss this matter with India. We have discussed it in the past, and I don't see why we cannot sit across the table and discuss it sensibly in the future. At one time, so many problems appear to be insoluble. But when the disputants got together and sat across the table, many of these issues were resolved. I have in mind principally the German question. I won't say it's completely resolved, but it has made great strides towards a resolution. I fail to understand why the same cannot be done for our disputes. We are prepared to enter into negotiations with India for the settlement of this dispute.
What is your opinion of the Arabian Alliance's position on Israel?
I have answered this question by saying that we would like to see the settlement of the Middle Eastern problem. Our position on the question is again based on principles. We do not believe that reiteration of these resolutions of the United Nations solves the problem. Now that you are to take a new initiative in trying to resolve this problem, or at least this is what we read from the newspapers, and that you have put into harness a new Secretary of State designate to take charge of the situation. Let us hope that your efforts succeed.
We rarely have a lunch without a Watergate question. Were the Pakistanis surprised at our Watergate and the handling of it by the Congress and the hearings?
we discussed with your president problem of waterlogging in Pakistan. We are fed up of waterlogging. We've had too much of waterlogging. Now, that's our problem, that's of waterlogging, but your problem is your own problem. And how can we interfere in it or express any opinions? Far be it from any friend from the outside to tell the American people that what are the necessary ingredients in this problem and how it should be resolved. It is a question which affects you directly. It is essentially a domestic problem. It is undoubtedly a matter which you have to resolve. You make these gadgets. You're mighty proud of them. And you get so terribly upset when you use them. But more seriously speaking, and if you don't misunderstand, because we cannot be partisan, our friendship is with the American people. Our friendship is with the American nation. It is not with an administration. We have to deal with successive administrations. At least my country has to deal with successive administrations. And there might be a different administration in the United States 3.5 years from now. So it is not a question of taking a position. But from the outside from where we are, when we look at it, we do find that a kind of vacuum is existing in international relations, and this vacuum we do not think is in the interest of world peace. We believe that if this vacuum is filled, it would contribute enormously to the quest for world peace.
Thank you. Last year, Pakistan withdrew from CETO. What do you see as Pakistan's future role in CENTO?
We withdrew from CETO for good reasons, and those reasons are self-evident. I say they are self-evident because the American press did not react surprisingly to our withdrawal from CETO. CENTO is an alliance which is there. It's the United States is not a member of CENTO as such, but United States participates in the CENTO conferences. We are guided by your thoughts on these matters, and we read carefully the trends in the United States itself on these issues. So much has been written about these arrangements having become obsolete. If the arrangements have become obsolete, it is for all member states to consider them to be obsolete. For the time being, CENTO exists, and willy-nilly, we are in it, for better or for worse, because we are with you.
You say you invite foreign investment in Pakistan, yet you also say Pakistan believes in the economic socialism of Marxism, which is generally interpreted as government ownership, at least government control. This point needs further clarification, the questioner says, before there can be much foreign investment.
Many years ago, in the beginning, when you began to deal with independent Asian states, you had, I think, different concepts of foreign investment and the role of private sector against the public sector. But now you have seen yourself that because of the great differences in our social structure and in your society, that nationalization or the control of the public sector over the economy of these states is not something which causes undue alarm. It has become an inherent part of our social milieu, and the process of nationalization is taking place in many parts of Asia and Africa, and the United States has now taken a more realistic and a sophisticated view of these developments. Now, if you can invest in the Soviet Union, which is a communist Marxist state, and if you can invest in Yugoslavia, and I suppose in a few years' time, we might see even Pepsi-Cola factories in Peking. So I fail to understand why our modest nationalization program should be a deterrent to the investors of the United States.
Would you like to philosophize on this? What is your general feeling about superpowers and the independence of small countries?
The superpowers are superpowers, and they have now entered into a détente. We welcome it if it's going to lead to world peace and to the elimination of tensions and local wars. That would be undoubtedly a salutary development. But some people feel that the détente might lead to a division of spheres of influence. We do not share this pessimism, the pessimistic view of the détente and the dialogue you are having among the superpowers. We hope that there is a productive element in these new arrangements for a new international structure. But if, God forbid, at some stage the idea entered the thoughts of the superpowers that it would be more convenient to them to have spheres of influence carved out, I think it will be an illusory quest, because nations, no matter how small they are or how weak they are, they will always assert their independence, and the romance of revolution will overtake the physical powers of the great powers.
Before our final question, Prime Minister, I would like to present to you, on behalf of the National Press Club and the press in Washington, our certificate of appreciation.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
I also have this delightfully bright National Press Club necktie.
Thank you.
I hope that you have a suit with which it will go well. And I have a question here. We're still going around on this White House meeting. At the dinner last night, you told Dr. Kissinger he had already allotted part of his armament, namely actresses Raquel Welch and Jill St. John. You then added that anyway, you didn't want obsolete arms, but red-hot stuff. Are you saying these symbols of American beauty are obsolete?
No, not at all. I'm sorry if my remarks have been misunderstood, but they were meant in the best of spirits.
Thank you, Mr. Prime Minister. Thank you.
Today's guest at the National Press Club, President Zulfikar Ali Bhutto of Pakistan. In a very brief speech, he touched on several points, particularly that he'd like to see relations with both India and Bangladesh, the nation which was carved out of East Pakistan after the 1970 war with India, improve. He said this could be possibly the key goal of Pakistani foreign policy for the next few years, and he expressed the hope that the United States would join in helping to promote that. He also felt that relations between the United States and Communist China, improving as they did, will also help to ease tensions in the Asian subcontinent. Also, with reference to his long-going dispute with India over the territories of Kashmir, Mr. Bhutto said that he felt that this could be negotiated. He said many problems seem insoluble, but that once you sit down around the conference table, why, things can be solved. He avoided any serious comment on the question of just what he and President Nixon discussed. There were reports that the Pakistani government was asking for a rather large number of new weapons, as he described them here, hot weapons. Right now there is an embargo on arms shipments, on offensive arms shipments, to both India and Pakistan. And in the past, Pakistan has pressed for a lifting of that embargo. However, President Bhutto, in a rather diplomatic way, avoided all comment on that issue, referring only to the fact that the United States has had long-standing commitments to protect Pakistan, going back as far as John Foster Dulles, who was Secretary of State under President Eisenhower, and he said they have continued since then. So that concludes today's coverage of the National Press Club program. Technical assistance for this program came from Gary Henderson and Mike Teast. The program was made possible with funds provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. From the National Press Club in Washington, I'm Rich Adams, and this is NPR, National Public Radio.